Ladies and gentlemen, we submit for your humble and rather sexy ears an ambitious radio experiment. It isn't enough for any reasonable journalist to talk to Peter LeRoy, the famed aviator who flew across the nation and came home to become the bird boy of Babington. Why do that when you can talk with the man himself who created Peter LeRoy, Eric Kraft? Our young roving correspondent read over 1 million words of this marvelous epic and sat down over 2 locations to talk in a high-octane gabfest that may have you redefining the very nature of fiction and reality itself. This is the first part of a 3-part literary extravaganza. Beat that, Silverblad.
Okay, so I am here with Eric Kraft, who has written a million-word epic involving a character named Peter LeRoy, and who is most recently the author of Flying. Eric, how are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Well, here we have a rather prodigious conversation, I suspect, and I will start with a very prodigious question to set the tone. In Peter's introduction in Leaving Small's Hotel, he writes, "It is a curious kind of partnership, Kraft and LeRoy. The usual descriptions, author and character, ventriloquist and dummy, left brain and right brain, are inaccurate and inadequate. When we were just beginning to work together, Kraft may have thought that in me, he had merely found a way to write about himself, and I may have thought that I found a ventriloquist who was willing to play the straight man while I got the laughs. But as time has passed, each of us has found himself liberated by the other, and each of us has found that to a certain degree, he has become what he is through the agency of the other. We are not the same person, though we share a mind." Now, I'd like to start off this conversation to determine precisely where Eric Kraft ends and Peter LeRoy begins, because I'm wondering how precisely you are liberated, personally, mm-hmm. by Peter LeRoy, and to what extent you almost become LeRoy in the act of writing, or is the act of liberation one that is intended for the reader, so that this mind that you're talking about in this particular introduction is something that becomes a perspective to share in the act of reading?
Mm-hmm. Actually, both. It's liberating for me, and I hope that it is liberating for the reader, too. Everything originates with some experience of mine, whether it's a first-hand experience or a vicarious experience from reading, from conversations with friends and people I've met, from movies viewed, that sort of thing. Everything originates with me. But then it goes through this process of transformation in which I make it Peter's instead of mine. And the most valuable thing about that process for me is that it forces me to re-examine and even reimagine what has happened in my life. So because of Peter, I haven't been able to take the easy way out, to just create the sort of 1950s that used to come up in MTV videos all the time, where it's just a number of stock images that immediately scream 1950s. Instead, it's Peter's 1950s, an alternative version of the 1950s, certainly not the version that I lived through.
You're saying then that for the 9 novellas of Little Follies, that this was in some sense a reaction to the MTV phone nostalgia that cropped up during there? That this was
Actually, they all predated MTV.
Oh, yeah, that's true. They came in the 70s.
When we saw that, yeah, absolutely. It's I wouldn't say it's a reaction, because by that time, I'd become so committed to Peter's version of things that it had become self-sustaining, self-supporting. So being forced to re-examine everything at that level has also forced me to make an alternative version. And in that sense, it's liberating because it liberates my imagination.
But there is this question of the reader as well, because, yes, it's liberating for you personally, Eric Kraft, and it may very well be liberating for Peter LeRoy, who is the author within the author. Right. But simultaneously, it makes me wonder whether the shared mind is how this becomes an act of liberation on behalf of the reader. Because is it really this kind of alternative sliver of reality, or is it something that essentially the perspective creates the act of liberation that is shared with the reader?
I think that it is an invitation to join in this reimagination of a time that we lived through, because I can never make my imagined version as complete as life is. Impossible. However, with the collaboration of the reader, it can be a little more complete. Peter, at one point, talks about his affection for the series of adventure books for boys, the Larry Peters Adventures. And he says that one of the things he liked so much about those books was that there were gaps between the chapters. And these were the places where he felt that he was being invited to fill those gaps with things that he imagined himself. And I think that there are these inevitable gaps in what I've created are places where the reader is invited to create again an alternative of what the reader's experience has been.
Does a new book or a new story, is it a matter of filling in the gaps? Because as you create this rather mammoth narrative, you're dealing with a scenario in which you create further gaps that are also stories that are retold often a second or a third time. In fact, in the Flying Trilogy, you make numerous references to all the other books.
Yes.
And I'm curious as to, are you really filling in the gaps, or are you, I suppose, paving over the gaps, it might be argued?
Well, first of all, I hope I'm pushing the whole thing forward. Peter is so digressive. He has so many things he wants to cover. He changes his mind about things. He goes back to things he's covered in the past, that he makes only a very hesitant, slow progress forward. There's a lot more lateral progress, I think, than there is forward progress. But I feel compelled to push forward. He's just about to meet Albertine, and it has taken me 10 books to bring him to that point. And once they meet, of course, there's a whole love affair for them that I've got to cover.
Yeah.
So
that's coming in the next book, the Albertine.
Yes.
Wow, okay. I was about to ask you, because you kind of pulled a switcheroo at the end of the third book of Flying, because I was thinking, oh, the Sturt is here, or the dark-haired lady, because you allude to this at the very beginning. And we're led to believe that it's almost as if this is kind of like one of those television series in which when we know that they're actually going to meet, it might actually end up killing the series. Are you worried about this particular?
Well, no, because of this way that he keeps looping back. In fact, we already know what he's going to say to Albertine when he meets her, because he mentions it at the end of Passionate Spectator. And Albertine tells him how well it worked. So all of the suspense is gone from that, and now instead it will be about other things that happen when they meet.
Well, on a basic level, all of your books are involving an alter ego to some degree. You have an author, you are an author writing about an author, and sometimes, as in the case with Passionate Spectator, the alter ego begets an alter ego, which then begets another alter ego, and this particular book is also an expansion of the attempt you made with Reservations Recommended with the Beef Matthew Barber scenario. But I'm wondering, when does one begin to separate the alter ego from a secondary character? I mean, is it a question, much like the one posed by Miss Rheingold, of something that's impossible to reconcile, even though you have engaged in so much research and so much thinking about the particular question? Are all the characters so deeply involuted with each other that really it's not necessarily a matter of it being an alter ego or a secondary character? It's a matter of the function of the character. Like in Matthew Barber's case, he's sort of a pragmatic counterpart to Peter LeRoy's dreamer. I mean, in the Flying Trilogy, he's the one who takes the direct flight there as opposed to the stages of the hops. Mm-hmm. He's the guy who's the stiff guy in Where Do You Stop?
Right.
Where he's the one trying to take all the joys of curiosity out of the equation.
Right.
So I'm curious why of this notion of the alter ego and the secondary character, is the distinction matter so much, or is it a scenario in which, you kind of just have to roll with the punches?
You know, for me, the distinction keeps shifting while I'm working, and I sometimes fail to remember that the thing I must remember about Matthew Barber, for example, is that very much of what Peter is telling us about him, he does not know. That he lost track of Matthew Barber and so on, and so he's constructed a plausible life for him. But that Matthew Barber that we know from Reservations Recommended can't be regarded as the same Matthew Barber that Peter knew. And so I'm constantly, you know, giving myself that little dope slap thing and saying, you know, you have to remind yourself that what you set out to do and what you are doing, even if sometimes you blind yourself to it by making these characters feel like secondary characters rather than alter egos, is to reveal the mind of Peter LeRoy.
Yeah. Would you say that they are twins, similar to the twins who frequently crop up in your books? I think of, for example, the twin sisters, Glynn, as well as also Ella's twin brother, Suitors, one of witch who dies in Herb and Lorna, colliding into the Atlantic. I'm curious about this notion of twins and how this ties into the notion of alter egos and secondary characters. Is it a matter where every particular Matthew Barber who exists has another Matthew Barber in another chronicle of the tale, or what?
That could be.
Yeah.
I haven't managed to do that, but it could be. I think the twinning is all about this notion of having an alternative version and having, if you have two versions, then each version is in some way a comment on the other. I think it's part of what my tendency to parody is, that when I make an alternative version of a character or of myself, it seems to me that that version inevitably turns out to be a parody to a greater or lesser degree. And I do find that when I'm working with Matthew Barber, I tend to think of him as a character, which is to say almost a person, rather than simply as Peter's creation. But then when I remind myself that, in fact, this Matthew Barber from Reservations Recommended is Peter's creation, then I'm taken back to an earlier conception of what I wanted to do with the work, which is to reveal the mind of Peter LeRoy.
But by revisiting Matthew Barber later, you're essentially able to determine a greater purpose for Matthew Barber in the whole of Peter LeRoy's narrative?
Or? Yes, and I think he's gotten a much larger purpose. So has Mark Dorsett, who looked as if he disappeared for a while but is about to make a big comeback. They do develop not only their own personalities but also their own motives and goals as they remain within the work, and sometimes I feel that I've just got to go in and help them accomplish those goals. So Mark's about to get his own book, for instance, and that's because he keeps knocking on the door and saying, I'm here, I have things I want to say.
Was this the case also with, like, the other characters, like Rascal and Porky and the like, that they just constantly knock on the doors and they find their way into these larger lives?
They do. Porky especially. I mean, for a long time, I'm not quite sure whether Porky is still alive at this time, at the present time for Peter LeRoy. Yeah. For a long time, however, I've known that Porky wants Peter to write, in effect, the authorized history of the Captain Clam fast food franchise. Yeah. And Peter's going to have to get around to doing that. I think it will be one of the projects of his company, Memoirs While You Wait.
Yeah, got it. I wanted to also ask about the Spirit of Babington, the arrow cycle that Peter rides to New Mexico. It does not, for the most part, fly, and it is very much like the shortwave radio that Guppa attempts to construct for Peter in the Static of the Spheres.
Right.
It's something that doesn't function, and yet Peter is capable in both of these instances of finding something special or magical about it. The magic increases, I would add, later in Peter's life in the sense that he's now able to talk with this malfunctioning machine and find this particular magic. And this makes me wonder if we accept that Peter's perspective is evolving over the course of these books. If he were to go back and, say, write about the incident of the shortwave radio, you would have a totally different story now as to what Peter LeRoy is. Yes. And I'm wondering if there's a problem here, perhaps, with Peter, in that the memoirs that he's previously written are possibly too permanent for him to return to, and whether this is something you have factored into the course of the series, and whether efforts to revisit a particular motif like this, the malfunctioning machine that is magical, is a way for him to return to something that has already been permanent in some sense in a previous chapter.
Yes. He says at a couple of points that one of the things that's happened as he's written his memoirs is that his telling of his life in the books that he's produced has begun to replace his memories of the actual events. And he cannot quite do what you just described. He can't quite go back to the memories that led to the writing because, first of all, he has an obligation to the integrity of the memoir that he's producing. He does contradict himself sometimes. He even in flying returns to Little Follies and reads through all of the memoirs that are there, and Albertine asks him what he thinks of it, and he says, well, I made some mistakes about Porky White and so on. His age doesn't seem quite right. He can't imagine how he could have known his mother in the way he seems to know her. And so he has this conflict between memory and imagination, and that is the essential thing that this entire work is about, that conflict between memory and imagination and also wishful thinking, the sort of aspirations that we have for ourselves that we wish we had realized in our lives and happened.
But I should also point out that he also knows, as he's writing these memoirs, that things are not particularly right. So why then would he have to complain about something after the fact? Because I suggest that it's more of this idea of memoirs being permanent. It's also almost a debilitating presence upon Peter's ability to remember other incidents in his life, because everything's constantly being modified, tinkered with, reconstructed, and the like. So I'm wondering how
That's
you
true.
Reconcile this particular dilemma here.
I haven't been trying to recollect. I didn't really think of it in those terms. I mean, but you're right. Because the books are there, and as they are there as they are, he's painting himself into a corner. Exactly. That what he's done is going to turn out to be what he is, and it's hard to escape that. I guess that's really something of the something similar to the problem that he faces in flying, where he has allowed the story of his flight to become what it is, which is not the real story. And because of his passive acceptance of this story, he is painted into a corner of a tissue of lies that are not really of his making, but they are something that he allowed to others to make.
I'm wondering if this is also why his memoirs have become more fanciful as they've gone along, and more magical, in the sense that he's talking to machines, in the sense that things are becoming a little bit more in the magical realist sense, because he's running out of corners to paint in, perhaps.
That could be. I think one reason is that he's aging. Yeah. He's so much older than when he began this project, and that there's a bit of a liberating factor to aging, that he was very concerned when he began about not wanting to make a fool of himself in print. And I think that at his present age, he doesn't mind so much.
Yeah.
He's not as worried about that. His ego is not something he feels he has to protect quite so much as he did.
Yeah, the Don Quixote principle, inflating a dog as well. I mean, it seems to me, people have compared this to Proust, but from my mind, it's more Don Quixote-like.
Particularly the second volume. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Discounting the many epigraphs that pop up throughout the Leroy books, it's often an outside work that is fabricated that often enters into the text and instance into the telling of the tale that often triggers certain events in the memoirs. I'm thinking of the Larry Peters books, which we were talking about before, which first really crop up in Call Me Larry. The foreign films in At Home with the Glynns.
Right.
The Fosterol translations in the Flying trilogy that young Peter is in the process of engaging with. I'm wondering, though, but if every representation is a misrepresentation, how then can any representation from Peter be defended? I mean, are Peter's representations defensible because they are delivered with these anecdotes, because there is a secondary source or a way of confirming something or a way of fabricating something, therefore, I suppose, confirming this imaginary impulse? What of this, Samara?
I don't think anything of his can be accurately traced back to something solid. I think it all shifts. It all rests on a very shifting foundation, which is simply all of my memories and all of my imagination. He is just a figment of my imagination. I'd have to be really mad if, in fact, he were as real as I. And so I said that I wanted to make a book that was about the mind of Peter Leroy, and I've also said many times that when I started trying to write, like most people, I wanted to write about myself, and found that I couldn't do it because I was too protective of the self who would have to be at the center of that work. And so that one aspect of the liberation of Peter was that he could become the self at the center. But what I've realized more and more as I watch these books grow and the number of them increase is, oh my God, I'm doing just what I set out to do, which is writing about myself. But to get there, to see the way in which these books are about me, is not something most people will be able to do. But I will tell you now, for example, that the scratchy red sofa that Peter remembers from the living room of Herb and Lorna, when he never suspected that secretly they were creating the animated erotic jewelry business is exactly the sofa that was in my maternal grandparents' living room. And the woman sitting there, Lorna, working with her slide rule at night, entertaining herself with mathematics problems, is my maternal grandmother. But my maternal grandmother had nothing to do with the animated erotic jewelry business, so far as I know.
Yeah. Gotcha. Well, I mean, I know that when you started writing, you initially were trying to write from some first-person plural until the Peter LeRoy impulse came along.
Right.
Do you now feel, after decades of doing this, that you have truly pinpointed your ability to express yourself, that really this kind of prevarication that we're talking about here through the filtering perspective of Peter LeRoy is really the way for you to truly access the center? Or are all these books essentially something of almost a protection shield, because we recognize that the book is this prism between author and reader? It's this kind of middleman, this halfway point, this halfway house, whatever you want to call it. And so as a result, by nature of the medium, well, you almost kind of have to have something like Peter LeRoy instead of, say, Eric Kraft writing a memoir about himself.
You have described exactly where I've found myself in the last year and a half or so. As I was bringing Flying more or less to a conclusion, Mark Dorsett, as I said, kept knocking on the door. And what he wanted to do was to write a book called Risking the Ridiculous, which would be about the relationship between me and Peter, the relationship between the work, my work, which is larger than this work but contains this work, and the relationship to myself and my thinking, my writing, and so on, rather than Peter's, which is contained within it.
Yeah.
So he's begun that book. He interviews me now and then.
Really?
Yeah, he sits across from a marble table from me and asks me questions. And I'm surprised that I've come to this point, because really I thought that it was very important for me to avoid doing this. Of course, I'm still not quite there, because Mark's going to write this book. I'm not.
Yeah.
But I'm back at that point of wanting to say something about myself and the way I think, and to do it a little more directly than through Peter. I think, you know, one reason is that over the years, Peter has become more and more separated from me. He and I are less and less alike as time goes by. And it may be partly as a result of what you talked about earlier, the fact that his life is now locked into something that I've made sufficiently distant from my own that we have to be more separate as time goes by.
Yeah. Is this why we have, as I noticed, Peter LeRoy instead of Eric Kraft?
Yes.
Here on the heading as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Exactly.
Well, I also wanted to ask about some of the many conflicts that Peter has. I mean, Peter sets up this journey early on. He includes a helpful explanation in the chart that indicates his need to digress. He writes, "To digress, you must begin by traveling a route that will get you where you intend to go. You must have a goal and a plan for achieving it in order to depart from it. You cannot digress from the right path unless you are already on it." And yet, Peter does acquire a number of maps obtained from gas stations. He then tapes these up on the wall, and then he decides to do away with these maps. And then he writes, "Having no map forced me to ask directions of strangers, and along the way I learned that doing so leads to fascinating exchanges. Exchanges that are, more often than not, useless, but fascinating nonetheless." But then he writes that if he has to take his journey all over again, well, he would do so without a map, because he's decided in hindsight that maps are more trustworthy than the advice of strangers. So it seems to me that there's a kind of conflict going on here, almost a tragic conflict, because on one hand, he wants to digress. He wants to meet those particular strangers. On the other hand, he would, if he had to do it again, he would do it through this kind of topographical thrust, and he becomes just as trapped by living on that particular structure and avoiding the digression if he goes that particular route. So what of this notion of revisiting a possibility in hindsight like this? You know, when Peter buys the candy bars also, it's Albertine who comes up to the clerk,
yes.
and expresses the magic of receipts.
Right.
And it's a wonderful little passage. And this leads me to wonder if Albertine is something of an enabler so that Peter can occupy this disparity between what he did in the past, allegedly, and what he's coming to terms with in the present, which actually also might further be tinkering as well.
Yes.
What he insists he would do now if he had that particular chance again. I mean, could Peter even function without her? I mean, is it your suggestion? I'm wondering, though, if it's your suggestion that, you know, every dreamer along these lines, you know, needs a muse. I know that's a lot to throw at you, but...
Yeah. An enabler, certainly she is. And muse, she certainly is. But she also grounds him in the best sense of ensuring that, you know, if his head is in the clouds, his feet are somewhere near the ground, at least. And she, at the same time, encourages him. She establishes for him a space within which he will be free to let his imagination roam. He wouldn't be able to accomplish much of anything at this point in his life without her. Clearly, when he was a boy, before they met, he attempted many things.
Yeah.
Nearly none of them ever worked out as he hoped they would, or even worked out at all. And that's a pattern that has extended into his mature, can we dare to call him mature, into his later life anyway.
Yeah.
But Albertine, she smiles lovingly at his quirks and follies and the strange things that he tries to do. But she's also there to say, you know, Peter, it's time to calm down, sit down, and look at this rationally.
But simultaneously, one might also consider that Albertine may also be a figment of his imagination. Certainly, that's what I thought.
Dare you?
Well, I'm telling you, you've been holding back on this whole meetup between him and Peter.
You've found something that hardly anyone has even dared to suggest. But I have asked myself several times whether that could be the case. I'll just ask the question. I don't have an answer for this yet. You know, that is Albertine Peter's way of keeping himself under control?
Yeah.
To a degree. I don't know yet. I don't know that I want to
certainly possible.
Explore that much more, but it's possible.
Since he is in the process of concocting composite characters like Rascal, his childhood friend,
right.
Since Matthew Barber is fictive sometimes and possibly real in some sense,
mm-hmm.
And since you have constantly avoided the question of how he met Albertine, this is
Although that's coming up.
Yeah. I know you've settled that.
But even if you read it, you'll still be asking yourself whether he might not have concocted this, and I'll be asking myself too.
Got it. But also back to this initial thrust of the last question of the difference between having a charted map and
I digressed, didn't we?
But the difference between strangers versus maps, there's a particular distinction there in the sense that he's happy to think about meeting strangers in the past, whereas he's not so comfortable with that in the present,
right.
Even though he's, in a sense, possibly reconstructing what he really did. And so this leads me, again, to ask about the conflict of the past versus the present, and perhaps these schematics and these diagrams and these ephemera that pop up throughout all of the books is really his way of providing, I suppose, a skeletal structure with which to, I guess, suggest that he would do certain things in his memories that maybe he didn't do, maybe he did do, or what.
Yeah. The conflict, I think, is between his desire to have life come at him whatever way it will and simply take it as it comes. And his desire now, especially at this time in his life, to get certain things done, certainly to bring his memoirs to a point where he's met the love of his life, which he hasn't managed to do yet. So I think that's the real conflict, and it may be a conflict between memory and present action. The comparison he has Mark make is between Peter and Phileas Fogg in Around the World in 80 Days, whom Verne described as being very much a straight-line person who would plan his journey so that he wouldn't rub against humanity too much, because doing that would slow him down and send him off in different directions, which of course is exactly what happens in the journey. Instead, Fogg's best laid plans are constantly disrupted by contact with other people. And Peter says, I'm no Phileas Fogg. I rub against people. And he sounds Whitman-esque when he's saying, you know, he relishes this contact with people, and that generates friction and slows him down, but at the same time generates warmth. So there's this seething, teeming side of his life as it's been lived, and he's remembering it, that's full of this human contact. And in the writing, of course, in the memory, you're tugged in so many directions by all the people you have come in contact to. If you ever want to get it written, if you ever want to get this life recorded, you've got to take more of a straight line. And some of those people are just going to have to fall by the wayside. You can never treat them all. And so there's the conflict, I think, between living life and getting it written down. Thoreau said at one point, I think it's on, it might be the Concord and Merrimack or before that, excusing lapses in his journal, that when we're living life fully, the last thing we want to do is write about it. Yeah. And so here's Peter reflecting, and he really, the first thing he wants to do is write about it. But of course, when he was living it, that was not the first thing.
But here's the dilemma. I mean, if he is fearful of these happy and joyful and brilliant moments that he sets down on paper, this seems to me almost kind of a fragmentation of consciousness. I mean, I should point out that Bellotomy Bay, I mean, Bellotomy is an anagram of lobotomy.
Right.
I don't think that was an accident.
No.
So if he is terrified of actually approaching people, or if his only way of approaching people is through the reconfiguration of his memories, this strikes me as an immensely tragic scenario. You know, that it's maybe not so much a disconnect as it is a sort of almost complete capitulation of one's consciousness, you know, to the page.
Well, I don't think he's afraid of that contact. But I wouldn't quite say that the tragedy lies there. What is tragic for me about his story, his entire story, is that, to me, it's all about loss. He loses the people who've been dear to him in every book. They fall away. They're dying. His maternal grandparents die in Herb and Lorna, and his paternal grandmother suffers a terrible death in Passionate Spectator. And yet he finds the humor in this. It's another subject we'll have to say, but we'll have to think about. But the tragedy, I think, is partly in his impossibly wanting to hang on to these people and these memories, to somehow get them into a mutable form in the books. Now this takes us back to what you'd mentioned. Once he's done, if he's managed to get Herb and Lorna onto the page so that they will be there and they won't change ever again, well, then he's also taken some of the life out of a certain part of his own life and out of his grandparents' lives. But
he is also trying to reclaim an identity, particularly in the Flying Trilogy. He's trying to reclaim the Bird Boy of Babington scenario. Now,
oh yes, he very much wants it both ways.
Yeah,
he wants to take a stance for truth and say, I really want the record corrected. I want it to be as it was and not as it wasn't. However, I will accept all the adulation if you're still willing to give it to me.
But having it both ways like this, is this symptomatic of the Liberty Valance maxim, you know, print the legend, essentially? That he will always print the legend, that he will never quite print the truth? Or is the truth essentially what we remember? Because, again, there is this additional notion that all the fabrications beget these very intriguing little maxims about life and the like, you know?
Right. I he does print the legend, yes, but I think he's always pointing... sort of lifting up the arras and saying, look at all that junk behind here, so that you know that there's dirt swept under his carpet or hidden behind the drapes. He may not be quite willing to say directly what the shortcomings might have been in himself and in his experiences, but he's willing to give enough of that to the reader so that the reader may be able to fill in quite a lot of gaps.
But simultaneously going back to the relationship between he and Albertine, the problem here is that one can view this that Peter, and you actually have the moment in the Flying Trilogy where egoists enter the equation.
Right.
But it is a very, as he presents it, egoistic relationship that he has with Albertine, who he's constantly reading her chapters at every single moment, and she has a lot of patience all throughout the Peter LeRoy Chronicles. And we do see slivers of, you know, how much he gives back to her. But it's interesting that he's more concerned about himself than he is about, and also about, like, oh, well, if she, particularly a passionate spectator, oh, well, if she is in a bad mood, I'm going to feel terrible. Which, again, gets to this enabling aspect that we were talking about earlier. I'm curious as to why we never really see much of how Peter cares for Albertine. Or is he really caring with her, or is he not even aware of how he's caring with her because he's so much in love with the universe and with his marriage and with everything else?
Well, I think she's the center of his universe, so he cares for her as much as everything else put together. I mean, she really is the heart of everything. And I hope that shows. I mean, when he runs to her after she's... fallen in the dog boarding accident,
that's right.
And the way he waits for her at the hospital while she's undergoing treatment and that sort of thing, she really is everything to him.
That's true, but he also disguises the root cause. It wasn't actually a dog boarding accident.
Right.
In fact, he's having that discussion with her in the hospital room, where he's saying, "Oh, I changed it in the book." So this is why I have to ask this particular question of whether this is really a sound.
She would expect him to do that. I mean, he does say that life is just the first draft of our memoirs, and that's exactly the way he looks at the situation. So she would expect that there would be a transformation that would occur before it made it into the memoirs, but. I believe that he writes these memoirs for her. That's the only reason that he's doing it. To entertain her, to impress her, to make her proud of him, and to seduce her. That's what this is for.
But do you think that he may be modifying certain real details because he doesn't want her to know that in text form? And also, this leads me to wonder about the constant sexuality that oozes throughout all of these particular books. They're, you know, Peter LeRoy's, he's rather a quick learner, and he makes some extraordinary boasts and claims about, you know, next-door neighbors and the like. Mm-hmm. So it's almost as if there is this kind of fantastical parallel with what his real feelings are. They're serving in lieu of his true... complicated Baroque love for Albertine.
Yeah. I think one of the most honest things Peter does is to make it possible for you to ask that question, that you can see the size of his ego through everything he writes, or through the accumulation of all the things that he's written. Albertine sees it too. She knows that he's playing with that, that if he wants to boast, if he wants to change the past in such a way that it becomes preposterously self-serving, he knows that so long as he steps back enough to allow that little gap of humor, of self-deprecating humor, she will get it. She will know that the gap is there and that she's that the grain of salt has already been added to the dish. She doesn't even have to do it on her own. So she's the collaborative reader in that way, except that she's actually more auditor than reader. She listens to him rather than reading what he's done. That she detects the full spirit of the work and receives the work exactly in the spirit he would like to have it received.